In the fall of 2018, historian Nathaniel Philbrick, his wife Melissa, and their dog Dora set out on a road trip to retrace George Washington's visits while president to the 13 original states. What came from Mr. Philbrick's venture is his latest book, titled Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. The U.S.'s first president said his goal was to bring the country together, and he traveled as far north as Kittery, Maine, and as far south as Savannah, Georgia. Here's what Nathaniel Philbrick learned on his two-year sojourn. Nathaniel Philbrick, one of the more interesting things I saw in researching for our chat was that you and David McCullough went to the same grade school in Pittsburgh. Do you know
that? That's right. Yes, Linden Elementary School. And I actually, we're of slightly different ages, so we never encountered each other in our younger years. But I grew up in his neighborhood and would ride my bike regularly past his parents' house. And we've talked about our great loyalty to Linden.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, he did a lot of his work on Martha's Vineyard, which is just 35 miles where you do a lot of your work on Nantucket, and you're both in the same field. What led you to get into this business of history and whaling and revolution and all that?
Well, I did grow up in Pittsburgh, the nautical equivalent, nautical center of the universe, but it was during summer vacations with my grandparents on the Cape that I learned how to sail, and that became a major drive in my life. And I sailed competitively in college and worked at a sailing magazine, Sailing World, that's now in Newport, for 4 years. And then my wife was a lawyer, and we decided that the commute we had from our suburb outside Boston was driving both of us crazy. We had two young kids, and I was pretty much at home with them, that she saw this job on Nantucket, and she had grown up on the Cape. That's where we had met. And we decided to go for it, even though neither one of us had much experience there. But I did know, having read my Moby Dick, that it was the port of the Pequod, and that made me pretty excited about moving to Nantucket. And almost as soon as we got there, I became just fascinated with its whaling history and began to research it between naps as far as my kids and that kind of thing. And then when my youngest got into first grade and I had till 2:30 in the afternoon, I began writing my first work of history, Way Offshore. And that really, I discovered this was what I was meant to do. It began with the history of my home, adopted home, Nantucket, and it's led me into the history of this country. And I'm just so grateful we made the move to Nantucket.
What's the difference between living on Nantucket for 30 years and living on the mainland?
You're on an island. You're 30 miles out to sea. You're all figuratively in the same boat. There is just this sense of community, particularly in the off season, that I've never experienced anywhere else. And, you know, weather is a participatory sport. The storms really are something that everyone's aware of and bonds people, really. And it's also, for me, the history of it. It's like a vortex into the past. When I was researching Away Offshore, my first work of history, I would take the kids to the places I was writing about on Nantucket. And even though it's only 14 miles long, it's intensely settled both by native peoples and the English settlers who arrived at the end of the 17th century. And so it was really, you know, it's just different there. You're on your own to a certain extent. Things changed a little bit when the fast ferry started in the late 90s, which reduced the ferry time of the ferry from 2.5 hours to just an hour. So we are a little more connected than we once were, but you're still out there. You're out away offshore.
When were you first introduced to John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie?
I read it in high school, and loved it. And then when I was on Nantucket, before I had made the transition from writing about sailboats to writing history, there was I learned that there was going to be a Steinbeck and the Environment conference on Nantucket. And I thought, hey, you know, I'm not an academic, but it would I'd love to write about Travels with Charlie and his final novel, The Winter of Our Discontent, which is sort of a thinly masked version of Sag Harbor, where Steinbeck lived, you know, another whaling port, but on Long Island. And that was when my engagement with Travels with Charlie became extremely intense, and it became almost personal when Elaine Steinbeck, Steinbeck's widow, she was 78 years old at that time, and their first summer as a couple had been spent on Nantucket when he was writing East of Eden. And my wife and I, being the unknowns at the conference, were given the honor of sitting on either side of her for dinner and talking to her about her husband heading out on the road. She said his health wasn't good. I was very worried about him. But when he said he was going to take Charlie, I knew everything was going to be all right.
When you decided to do Travels with George, you suggest that everything that we thought about Travels with Charlie wasn't quite accurate.
Yes. Since we met Elaine back in the early 90s, there have been actually some books written, some articles written by people who decided to follow Steinbeck's route and began to realize there's just no way what he's describing happened. And this particularly apparently becomes true when you study the first draft of Travels with Charlie, that I think it's some library in New York, and Elaine is a character through much of it. He traveled often with her. He wasn't all by himself with his dog, as he posits in the book. But, you know, that didn't bother me at all. You know, he's a novelist who's writing about the essence of what he experienced. It's still a great book, particularly when it comes to talking about what makes us Americans. And so, actually, when I learned that he didn't travel alone, that he traveled with his wife, I said, well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. My wife, Melissa, had just retired, and we had a new puppy named Dora. We were going to do our best John Steinbeck imitation and follow George Washington together as a couple with our dog.
You taught me something I didn't know about my own town here. When I read about Jones Point, where I've been, but I clearly wasn't paying close enough attention, about the Discovery Stone boundaries. Talk about that, and how did you discover it?
Yeah, well, it's amazing, really. You know, you go to D.C. and Alexandria, and you see all these great monuments to figures from the past. But the oldest federal monuments are the boundary stones that were originally planted in the ground at 1 mile intervals to determine the perimeter of what would become Washington D.C. And they're just, you know, little granite nubs the first one was planted there at Jones Point, right at the southern edge of Alexandria, right on the edge of the Potomac. And from there, they did a square with 10 mile sides, almost a diamond shape. You can find these today. Often there is a kind of a green metal cage over them. You'll find them in the middle of a sidewalk. Sometimes they're at the edge of a highway, but they're still, most of them are still there. There were 40 original, something like in their 30s, are still out there. And I just think it's just a wonderfully humble evocation of our national beginnings.
Well, you got me to go to YouTube and just put in the stones and Discovery Stones DC, and you can't believe how much is on there. And it's also, there's a whole website devoted to this. So I assume as you went on your travels, you found things like this all over. What are the four or five things that you remember from your trip that you didn't know about?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. we spent a lot of time on the web, even when we were driving, and the discoveries we made along the way, we just couldn't believe it. For example, we were in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and when Washington visited Portsmouth, New Hampshire, he got a harbor tour there at the river, and he stopped at what's now is Kittery Point, Kittery Point, Maine. Maine was then part of Massachusetts. But now, of course, it's part of its Maine, and he got on this old stone dock, and you know, there's accounts of him stepping out on that. And we everywhere we went, we were looking for dog-friendly accommodations, and we thought, well, hey, we've been in Portsmouth before, but we've never been to Kittery Point. Let's see if there's a place we can stay there. So Melissa did, you know, Verbo, and up came this listing for the Red Cottage, and in the description of the property, it was stated that when George Washington visited Portsmouth, New Hampshire in 1789, he stepped out of the boat onto the stone dock that the Red Cottage overlooks. And we went, oh my goodness, and asked if we could stay there. Unfortunately, it was booked for the night, but the owner wanted to talk to us. And so we went over, got a tour of it, got a chance to, you know, step onto this dock, and you know, you can't make this stuff up. You know, we were in Oyster Bay, Long Island, and I had, before we left, I had, before we headed out, I had made a list of all the towns Washington stayed in, went through, and there in his New England tour alone, there were 60 of them. And I reached out to the historical societies and libraries of each town, and they began to. I wanted to know what had been recorded of Washington's visit, and I began to get all sorts of information back. And from Oyster Bay, I received this newspaper account of a woman who, when she was 6-8 years old, named Sarah, she was standing at her gate in Oyster Bay. When who should ride past but George Washington on his horse, and across the street from her, they were building a one-room schoolhouse that would be there for more than a century, the Bungtown School. And Washington saw that they were building this, got off his horse, and volunteered to help them get one of the rafters up into the roof. You know, Washington was 6'4" tall and a tall man, and so he helped them. And when we were there, the historian takes us to the plaque for the Bungtown School. And it was like, wow, you know, here we are. This is where Yosero was over there. This is where the schoolhouse was. You know, it was just great. In the South Carolina, there is Hampton Plantation. A magnificent southern plantation. On your way, as we were coming down from the north on the way to Charleston, and when Washington visited there, they had just completed a new porch, and the owner of the porch didn't allow anyone to go up the steps until Washington had a chance to go up them. And Washington did that, and the woman who owned the plantation said that the live oak just in front of the porch, this magnificent tree with dripping Spanish moss, would have to be cut down because it was just right there in front of the new porch. And Washington, the supposed cutter down of his father's cherry tree, said, no, don't cut down that magnificent tree. The hand of man cannot replace that. Leave it. If you go to, and today, if you go to Hampton Plantation, there is that now a monster live oak right in front of the porch, a living monument to Washington's visit to the South.
Let's go back to the beginning. When did you decide to take this trip? When did you start it? And why did your wife, Melissa, want to go with you on this?
Well, we set out in the fall of 2018, and you know, it was, I had just finished my third book about the Revolution, In the Hurricane's Eye, about the year of Yorktown, and I had, you know, had had decided that, you know, I would really like to follow George Washington. I had had enough of bloodshed. I needed to change it up. I wanted to write a different kind of book, but I was still fascinated with Washington. I wanted to know what happened to him next. So I came up with this idea, and I tried to sell it to my wife, Melissa. And Melissa has a very healthy skepticism when it comes to some of my more fervent enthusiasms. And she had just retired, but she hadn't quite retired. She was in that transitional phase when she was, she had been a lawyer for 25 years, but had for the last 10 years had been the head of a nonprofit on Nantucket and was passing the reins on to another person. And so she was sort of in the midst of that. But I said, come on, why don't you come with me? We can, you know, bring Dora, our dog, and divide it up in ways so that we're not out there for too long, but it'd be fun. And she said, well, why would we bring a dog following George Washington? And I became a little defensive about that, but said, hey, he almost single-handedly invented the American foxhound, and he had names for his foxhounds like Tipsy and True Love and things like that. Anyways, and this began a dialogue between Melissa and me in which I would, you know, get very enthused about something, and she would sort of tap me on the shoulder and say, "Really?" And as a consequence, those kinds of dialogues are a part of the story as we follow Washington up and down the coastal America.
What kind of a car did you drive?
We drove a Honda Pilot, pretty big, roomy car. I think it's a 2015 Honda Pilot, dark gray. Plenty of room for Dora in the back seat. We quickly realized, staying at these places, that we had one during the New England tour. We had one unfortunate incident where Dora had chosen to swim in a kind of mud hole and was covered with dried muck by the time it came to us getting to the hotel. And once we got to the room, before I could get her into the tub, she jumped on the white coverlet of the bed. And anyways, it was not a good scene. And we soon learned that one of the things we needed to bring with us was a sheet to put over whatever bed was in our room. We brought along everything Dora needed to eat, and often we didn't quite know where we were headed. And Melissa was both the navigator and sort of logistical person, and would, you know, find us those places as we made our way across America.
How did you break up the trip, and did you take the trip all at one time?
We decided from the first we had to break it up. Washington didn't do it all at once. It was really four different journeys: a New England tour, a sail to Rhode Island that came and ratified the Constitution after his New England tour, the Long Island tour, and the Southern tour. And we decided to break it up along those lines, but also cut the New England tour and the Southern tour in half. We have our fathers, both in their 90s, are living independently on Cape Cod, and we really like to keep in touch with them. So we didn't feel we could be away for more than 2 weeks at a time. We also had our children who both lived in and grandchildren who lived in Brooklyn and wanted to stay in touch with them. And so we broke it up. I also had a book coming out sort of in the middle of it. And so this gave us the flexibility to sort of, you know, hit things one at a time. And it was really, when I look back, it was absolutely the right thing to do, because it was kind of grueling. We were meeting people at almost every town. So interview after interview, I was taking notes the whole time. And then at night I would, write out my notes on my computer, and then we'd leave the next morning and come back at dusk. And if I had been doing that the whole time, I think I would have died of exhaustion. So it was good to break it up.
How many nights did you stay in a hotel?
Let's see. I would say if we added it all up, it would come to about little less than 2 months of staying in hotels. And so we were on the road a lot. and particularly when it came to the southern trip, it took Washington 3 months to do the southern trip, almost 2,000 miles. We did it in less time, but there were a lot of stops along the way. What was great about the southern tour, particularly between Charleston and Savannah, is many of the roads he was on are still there, and they are no longer highways. That they're sort of off the beaten path, so that they were very much the way they had been. And so, you know, we didn't slow to a horse-drawn carriage pace, but it was pretty close.
I'm going to read a bunch of names and get you to talk about who they are. I'll be very quick. William Jackson, John Fagan, James Hurley, William Osborne, John Mauld, and I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but Fides Imhoff, and Giles and Paris, and also Tobias Lear. Who are they?
Okay, this is these are the names of Washington's entourage, the people, the aides, and two enslaved workers, Giles and Paris, who managed the baggage wagon and often worked as postillions, actually getting on the horses that were ahead of the carriage to help guide them over the rougher terrain. And then there was a variety of you know, other assistants along the way, handling the baggage and all that. Tobias Lear was really Washington's closest confidant during the early years of his presidency. He was a kid from Portsmouth who, out of college, got a job as one of Washington's secretaries in the years prior to his becoming president, and actually lived in Mount Vernon, got to know the family very well, and he would run the Washington household pretty much. He would accompany Washington during the New England tour, but by the Southern tour, he stayed, and by that time, the temporary capital had moved from New York to Philadelphia. And by that time, he was married and had a child. And so he stayed at the presidential residence with Martha and family. And it would be William Jackson, born in Scotland, fought in the Revolution, and had been the secretary of the Constitutional Convention, and was now an aide for Washington. And was a Southerner, had grown up in Charleston, so was a Southerner. And so he was the perfect person to accompany Washington during that Southern tour. And and this made up his rather humble entourage. And, you know, there was, you know, the closest to a security detail was William Jackson, someone who had been a soldier during the Revolution. But that was about it.
So if you happened to run in and into him when he was on the road, what would it all look like?
Yeah, it would be, first you would see his carriage. Let's go with his Southern tour. He had a two-seater carriage, which he called his chariot because it was smaller than his larger carriage that was left in Philadelphia. It was drawn by four horses, and you'd see that leading the way, but with some of his aides on horses riding beside the carriage or behind or ahead of it. There would be a baggage wagon behind, and then trailing behind the baggage wagon would be Washington's white horse, Prescott, his white steed that Washington would sometimes, when he would come to a town, he would stop the carriage, step out dressed in his general's uniform, mount Prescott, that great big white horse, and ride down Main Street to thunderous acclaim. You know, Washington really knew, after 8 years as general of the Continental Army, he knew how to make an impression. And so, sometimes you'd see Washington in his, you know, entertainment mode, but more often than not, he was in his carriage, being often with the local militia on horseback ahead of him, giving him an escort, which he didn't like because it kicked up dust that would, choke him in the carriage. So he would do everything he could to try to convince the local militias to not accompany him because it just made it for an unpleasant experience for him.
Did anybody keep a diary that you were able to look at?
Yes. Washington kept a diary, and it's a great resource. It's been published. It's part of his papers. Wonderful footnotes in terms of expanding upon the references he makes. And in fact, when we drove around following Washington, Melissa had the diary spread out on her lap. And so often we'd, pull into a town and she would recite what Washington said about the place. And so those are there. Also published are the addresses that were presented to Washington in each town and city he visited. Often they were from the Society of the Cincinnati, a group of American Revolutionary War veterans, or the ministers of a town, things like that. And so those are there, as well as Washington's written responses. And then there were all those local references that I talked about earlier that really expanded upon, how people's perceptions of Washington as he rode into town.
How many of the four different trips that he took to the 13 states were done in the first term?
Yes, in all of them were done in the first term. And in fact, all of them were done within his first 2 years in office. And so he really wanted this to be something that happened early, because he understood that when he became, when he was inaugurated president, there was already a divided country. The Constitution had divided the country into those who supported the Constitution and the strong government that it was created, that it created, the Federalists, and those who distrusted that government and wanted the power to remain with the states as it had been under the Articles of Confederation. They were known as anti-Federalists. These were not formal parties yet, but there was still a divide in the country. And you combine that with the fact that each state regarded itself as its own country. When the governor of Virginia said, "My country," he meant Virginia, not the United States of America. And so Washington decided he needed to go out there and visit all of these states, as many of the towns as possible, and show them that there was a new order in America. It wasn't just their town, their state. There was something called the United States of America, and he was now their leader. And so he wanted to do this early in an attempt. He knew he had a couple of years' grace, a honeymoon period, before the policies he was going to inevitably have to put forward became controversial. And so he wanted to get this done early. And he succeeded, I think, in creating a sense of nationhood among a group of 13 former colonies where that really hadn't been the case before.
Just in case somebody's listening and can't remember the 13, I'm going to go through them quickly. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, and Maryland. When he went on these trips, and you say he divided it up in four different trips, what was the longest that he was away?
Yeah, it was the southern trip, which was his last. And so, and this was... later, this was, by the time Hamilton, who was his Secretary of Treasury, had begun the economic policies were coming into clearer focus. And those were controversial. And so he headed out in the Southern tour, knowing it was going to be, not only was it going to be the greatest distance he was going to travel, but the roads were the worst, and the accommodations were also fewer and farther between, and it would. He was gone for 3 months, and he met with his cabinet. It was Hamilton and Jefferson and others, and said that if something should happen and you need me, He gave them his tentative itinerary, get a message to me, and I can be back right away, as in a month. So, luckily nothing came up that required his presence. And it's a good thing, because inevitably the messages that were sent from the temporary capital of Philadelphia missed him in certain crucial points and didn't catch up to him until he stopped at Mount Vernon before heading back to Philadelphia. And so, that's a long time to be away from the Capitol.
I understand he had a dog with him?
Well, there is a tradition that he had a dog with him on a southern tour, a greyhound named Cornwallis, for the British general that had been his great opponent during the Revolution and who had to surrender at Yorktown. I fell for this tradition hook, line, and sinker because I had my own version of Cornwallis with us. We had Dora. But one of the more fascinating aspects of this tour was learning as we went to town that some of these traditions that have become an accepted part of the history of Washington's travels are not necessarily true. And I hate to say it, but Cornwallis is one of them. We were in Augusta, Georgia. We had followed Washington from Savannah all the way into Augusta, into the interior. And Bill Kirby, who is a columnist for the Augusta Chronicle, was showing us around, and it was everything we know about Washington and Cornwallis comes from a article written in the Savannah Chronicle describing the discovery of a brick crypt during a road excavation project. And they uncovered this stone in which described Washington's tearful sadness upon burying Cornwallis, who had followed him throughout his tour. And Bill said, "Did you look at the date of that article in the Savannah Chronicle?" And I knew it had been in the late 1890s, but I hadn't looked at the month of it. He said it was April 1st. It was an April Fool's joke. We've since learned that we cannot find that tomb. Where it was supposedly occurred was so far away from where Washington was when he was in Augusta. There couldn't be. Yeah, it was all a fiction. And so that was one tradition we had to lay to rest.
There's in Chapter 5 a story about you on your back in Penn Station, dreaming of George Washington.
That's right. Well, George Washington, one of the reasons George Washington was so eager to go on these tours was that almost as soon as he became president, he was hit by these series of illnesses. He almost died several times in the first 2 years of his presidency, and he realized it was because he wasn't getting enough exercise, that the stresses of the office were really hard. He was not only the first president, he was creating the office of the presidency. And so he realized he really needed to get out of the office. And so in many ways, these tours were a way to reduce that stress. Well, following Washington had its own stresses, I discovered then. And I was in Penn Station on my way, actually, to a speaking engagement in Philadelphia. And that night before, both Melissa and I had come down with what may have been food poisoning, may have been some kind of intestinal bug, and woke up the next morning feeling completely drained and had to catch a train to Philadelphia. And so we were in New York and on Penn Station. When our train was called, I stood up with my knapsack full of books and suddenly blacked out and fell to the floor of Penn Station. Melissa, I woke up with Melissa beside me saying, "Nat, are you okay?" I said, "Oh, I'm fine. I got up as a policeman was coming towards me and an Amtrak employee and said, I'm fine, and then collapsed again. And while I was on the floor of Penn Station, cheek against that dirty tile, I began to dream. I had this dream, And that weekend, I had watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang with my four-year-old granddaughter. And in my dream, I was in the carriage with George Washington leaving New York on his New England tour. And the carriage magically takes off. It's the two of us in the carriage looking down at Manhattan below us with the sails of on the Hudson and East River below us. And then we land in Rye, New York, which was Washington's first stop on the New England tour, where he stayed at an inn that is still a tavern that is still there now, part of the Rye Historical Society. And there, in my dream, was were Melissa and Dora waiting for me in the Honda Pilot. And Melissa, I awoke, and I was, you know, eventually ended up in an ambulance, being taken to Bellevue Hospital, where it was determined I was simply dehydrated. And it was, you know, and I was just, it was an out-of-body experience. And it was while researching the New England tour, I learned that none other than the artist N.C. Wyeth had had a similar experience. He had been working on a painting of that depicts George Washington's visit to Trenton, New Jersey, on his way to New York for his inauguration. And it's the women of Trenton presented him with flowers and all this stuff. And it's a beautiful painting, really a mural, that he was installing on the ceiling and wall of a bank. He was up on a 30-foot scaffolding when he slipped and almost fell to his death. That it was so freaked him out that that night he dreamed of seeing George Washington giving him a tour of the Battle of Brandywine, which was right near where Wyeth lived. And in his dream, he was up on a scaffolding while Washington was on his white horse telling him about the battle that's happening around them. And he would then paint in a dream, I Dream of George Washington. And it's a fantastic painting. It's almost an expressionist kind of thing. And it's since become my favorite N.C. Wyeth image. And, you know, it's just one of those things that happened on our own tour that intersected in almost magical ways with other people's interactions with Washington.
Is that painting at their gallery there in Brandywine?
I think it is, but I actually ran into it when we were working on this. There was an N.C. Wyeth exhibit in the art gallery in Portland, Maine, and they had the painting. So I saw it in Portland, Maine, while I was working on this book, which was, you know, just another sort of fortuitous out-of-body experience. And it's a wonderful painting. I don't know. I assume it will permanently be back at Brandywine.
At the end of your book, you say Melissa still considers George Washington a mystery.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yes, I think anyone who has spent a significant amount of time researching George Washington's life has to ultimately say there are parts of this man that he purposely wanted to keep private. He instructed Martha to burn all their letters between each other. And we know those letters, there was voluminous number of letters. He was writing, particularly during the Revolution, writing to her all the time during his tour. Martha stayed at the presidential residence throughout these tours, and he was writing to her all the time. Washington's most inward thoughts are lost. And so I think there is a part of him that will always be in an enigma. And yet I have to say, after following him for a year and a half and experiencing him not just as a statesman or a general or a plantation owner, but as a traveler, I began to have, both Melissa and I had a sense of him more as a human being than, you know, we had ever before. But then ultimately, there is a part of him that he, you know, that we will never know. And you know, he gave this country so much. The revolution would not have been won without him. The presidency would not be the office it is today without him. We would not be a union of states, I am convinced, without Washington as president. And he gave this country so much. I think it's almost appropriate that, you know, he was able to keep his innermost thoughts to himself.
You write about his farewell address some. I read it after I read your book, and I was intrigued that he doesn't mention the issue that is still very much in front of us today, slavery. And you talk about slavery in the book, and people, you know, historians all the time, it seems to me, in some ways, let George Washington off the hook. They keep saying it was his wife's fault or whatever, and he, you know, he freed them. But is that really true?
Right. Well, you know, I you can't, and I determined even before we departed on this not to let George Washington off the hook. And because you're right, yes, he freed its enslaved workers, but it happened at the very end of his life. You know, he didn't do it any earlier. I mean, there's all sorts of complicating factors. It's a very complex legacy when it comes to Washington. But, you know, you can't give him an out-of-jail card when it comes to slavery. And you're right. He does not mention it in his farewell address. Washington's overall, his intense focus was on the Union. And he knew that if the issue of slavery if he pushed that too hard early on, he would alienate the Southern states, and his dream of a strong Union would inevitably fail. He made that judgment, and on the other hand, he also realized that for slavery to continue, it would ultimately undermine the Union. He was heard to say during his second term as president that if slavery should divide the country, he would go with the northern part, which is a pretty extraordinary statement from someone who was a Virginian. So, you know, Washington, it's really complex. Washington's focus was on the Union. He made that judgment call. He felt if he pushed the issue of slavery, there would not be a Union. And remember, it was the Union, the preservation of the Union, that led Abraham Lincoln, you know, 75 years later, to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. But you can't let him off the hook. You got to give him credit for moving beyond the unrepentant slaveholder he was before the Revolution. But ultimately, he was unable to completely free himself from the preconceptions he had grown up with.
You say in the book you have a new hero. We talked a little bit about the district boundary stones earlier, and a guy named Banneker. We have a high school here named Banneker High School. Why is he a new hero of yours?
Well, he was a free African-American from Maryland who was one of the surveyors at the beginning of the process of planting those survey stones that mark the boundaries of Washington, D.C. You know, he was pretty much self-educated. He was a mathematical genius, published his own almanac, reportedly built his own clock out of wood, and would do the mathematical equations and observations associated with the survey that began this country. And while he was doing that summer, while he was doing this, he wrote none other than Thomas Jefferson a letter, praising Jefferson for having written the Declaration of Independence and its statement that all people are created equal, but chastising him for being a slaveholder, asking him, you know, how could you write that statement and hold so many of my people in bondage? And you know, it was a letter that was widely circulated that Jefferson would respond to, but he was clearly not put in a very difficult situation by it. But there is, you know, there is someone, you know, actively surveying Washington, what will become Washington, D.C., an African-American who calls out Thomas Jefferson. So, yes, he is my new hero.
I'm looking at a list of all the books you've written, I think, trying to keep track of all them. I count 11 plus this new one. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's about right. I can't tell you the truth, the exact number either, but something like that, yes.
On that list, which one has been the most successful?
It's a tie between In the Heart of the Sea and Mayflower. Mayflower actually sold more when it first came out, but since In the Heart of the Sea was turned into a movie, that gave it a boost. 13 years later, sold it. So I would say those, in terms of just book number of books sold, those two.
Have you ever totaled the number of books you've sold altogether?
I've sort of talked in loose terms with my agent once, and it's a couple million, something like that.
Which one did you enjoy the most?
Oh, I enjoy all of them. They are like my children. What I love about what I do is that each book is I'm learning something new. I don't write these books because I'm an expert. I write these books because I haven't seen a book about a topic that I would like to read. And the learning process is what I so enjoy. And so each one is unique. In the Heart of the Sea was kind of where it all began for me, and my kids were still, in school, and so that has sort of an emotional resonance for me, but. You know, I have to say, Travels with George, Driving the Country with Melissa and Dora, it's been one of the more challenging, invigorating, and cathartic experiences I've ever had, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. So, I can't really honestly answer that question.
In 2014, 2017, 2018, if I count right, and tell me if my years are wrong, you wrote three books that revolved around the American Revolution: Bunker Hill, Valiant Ambition, and In the Hurricane's Eye. Do I have that right?
Yes.
If somebody took the time to read all three of those, they haven't read any of them, what are you going to get? What are you going to learn that you, if you didn't ever pay that close attention to the American Revolution, would you get it all?
I don't know if you'd get it all, but what you'd get is, I did not originally intend to write a trilogy about the Revolution. It began with Bunker Hill. I wanted to write a book about the city of Boston, which was then about the size of Nantucket, an island off, connected by a thin neck of land to Roxbury. I wanted to write about that island experiencing a revolution. And so that led me to the arrival of George Washington just a few weeks after the Battle of Bunker Hill. And that initiated my fascination with Washington, which I never saw coming. And so I wanted to find out what happened to him next. How would I get into the middle years of the war? Well, I wanted to pair him up with Benedict Arnold, who had always been my mother's hero, strange to say. And it focuses on those two figures as their lives go in very different directions during those middle years. And then there's the third book in which I really focus on the naval battle, the Battle of the Chesapeake that made the victory at Yorktown possible. I sort of began on a maritime theme, and that enabled me to end my engagement with the Revolution with a little-known naval battle in which no Americans really participated that allowed us to ultimately win our independence. And so, I think if you read those three, George Washington is the figure that makes his way through them, but there's also Nathaniel Green, Horatio Gates. There's a really a whole cast of characters that, with the end of the trilogy and in the Hurricane's Eye, the epilogue is a series of mini biographies of each character telling you what happened to them in the years after the revolution. And for me, that was a very, personally gratifying process in which I was sort of able to take the tangled yarns that had been going through this tapestry, if you will, and figure out where they all led.
Many years ago, we asked a young man to do a statue of Alexis de Tocqueville, and it was his first ever statue that he did, and we used it in our series on Alexis de Tocqueville. So when I got to page 258,
yep,
and saw Thomas Spratt and the Catawba leader King Hagler by Chaz Fagan, I just had to bring this up and ask you about Chaz Fagan's statue. He says that he had never gotten into this business until we asked him to do Tocqueville. So why did you put a picture of it in the book and write about Chaz Fagan?
Yeah, well, Chaz Fagan, we came across this statue in Charlotte, and we had just visited the Catawba Reservation, and this statue depicts one of the leaders of the Catawbas, and it's a great statue. And actually, when I was at the Catawba Reservation, I said, "What information do you have about Washington's visit?" And they said, "You should talk to Chaz Fagan, because he heavily researched that statue when he was working on it, and worked cooperatively with the tribe." And so I called Chaz up, and he told me the story of how you guys gave him his start. He's extraordinarily grateful. And he is a sculptor, but he's also a historian. And he grew up in the Pittsburgh area. And so we had that kind of as a bond. And he's just a wonderful guy. And this is another example of the kind of serendipity involved in this tour, of coming across this statue like this, and then meeting, talking to a sculptor who had such an personal and historical engagement with Washington in making the statue.
Before we close down, tell us about your writing environment. What do you write with? What time of day do you write? Where do you write?
Yeah, well, I treat it really as a job. Back when my wife was working I had a full-time job, I work in my basement office of our house on Nantucket. It's a book-lined study, and it's filled with the books I've acquired to research what I'm working on. And I try to be at my desk by 9 o'clock, and I work to a late lunch, usually between 12:30 and 1 o'clock, maybe a little later. Get lunch downtown on Nantucket. It's about a quarter-mile walk at the pharmacy. Then walk up my dog, Dora, and back at the desk, an hour, hour and a half later, work till 4 or so, and give Dora another walk, return, and then work till dinner time, 6 or 7 o'clock. And that's what I do. 75% of my time is research and note-taking. I work on a computer and create literally hundreds of pages of notes for each chapter that I then divide up, break into sections as I begin to write the chapter. I print the chapter, each day's work, and scribble over it, and then rewrite, and ultimately read that chapter, for a draft of that chapter, to Melissa, who usually while she's doing the dishes, and she then gives me her critique, which can be devastating, but it's also a great process by which to read what I'm writing. It's just a whole new way of looking at the material, and with her input, I rewrite it and send it to my father, who's 92, and on the Cape, retired English professor. He gives me his input, and once I've integrated that, it's on to the next chapter, and so it goes.
Next book?
I am headed to the gold rush. One of my favorite researching and writing experiences was The Last Stand, about the Battle of Little Bighorn. And I really miss the West. And this will give me the chance to, you know, head west. And, it happens by land and it happens by sea. Some of the 49ers came around the Horn or took a steamboat to the Isthmus. And so I'm really looking forward to it.
Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's great to talk with you again, Brian.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.